Our second case is 13-382, State of Ohio versus Kareem Gilbert. For the appellant, Melinda Makel.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, contract law controls here. The parties are entitled to get what they bargained for. The defendant in this case understood that his plea agreement was a contract. This is borne out by the fact that he agreed to withdraw his guilty plea because he had violated his part of the bargain. Not only did he agree to the withdrawal of the plea after it was withdrawn, he did not appeal that decision to the First District Court of Appeals, but he then entered into a new plea bargaining situation with the state and entered a new plea. His position now is not reasonable, it is not tenable, and the decision of the First District Court of Appeals does not preserve the integrity of the plea bargaining process, which is so important.
Counsel, isn't the first hurdle that you have here is that he was sentenced and prior to his the act that he was supposed to do to cooperate, which was the underpinnings of your plea bargain, and he was incarcerated and then brought back to testify, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It was about a year later.
Yes, about eight months.
And the Bethel case and the other cases that are cited here, there was no sentencing until the benefit of the bargain was received by the prosecutor, by the state, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So that's the hurdle that I think that you have to overcome here, is that once the sentence was imposed, you know, and I know the argument is that the prosecutor moves for vacating of the sentence, and you know, I read that that part of it, but I'm not sure that that's the strongest argument to make on that. But be that as it may, we've got the situation where he's incarcerated. But then, to make matters a little more complicated, he agrees to withdraw the plea and go forward.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then he gets, instead of 18 years flat, he gets 18 to life.
Which was, he agreed to. That was an agreed plea.
Right. And then a different appellate attorney, and that's how the whole thing gets started.
Well, an appellate attorney put forth an Anders brief saying that there was no error.
Right.
And then the First District asked for a briefing on the very issue that you're referring to, which has to do with the finality of the judgment and really about jurisdiction. And the response by the state is what happened in the concurring opinion that came back on the Anders brief. The judge who wrote that opinion referred to Pratts v. Hurley, this court's decision, that talked about the difference between subject matter jurisdiction and an error in the exercise of jurisdiction. That is where we went in the briefing in Gilbert too. And I think what was borne out there was that this, at best, could have been perceived by the defendant as an error of the court's exercise of jurisdiction. The court had subject matter jurisdiction. I don't think there's a question about that. The defendant, however, had an adequate remedy at law, and that was by way of direct appeal. He did not do so. He thereby
Counsel,
has
could we stop
it.
On that point for a second? You say there's no conflict there. I have difficulty. Once a trial court enters a sentence and says goodbye to the defendant and moves on to the next case, saying at some subsequent date, I'd like to reopen that case and revisit it. Are you telling me that they have subject matter jurisdiction at that point?
Not they.
The court.
This court did. I believe the cases that you are referring to, if I'm not mistaken, would include Raber, which was pretty recent.
I'm referring to the case before us this morning.
But when you're speaking of finality, I believe you're talking to Raber,
ma'am.
And to Carlisle. And I think that they are pretty easily distinguishable. First of all, none of the cases that have talked about finality, and certainly the court and the public has a very strong interest in finality, none of those cases involve plea bargain situations.
No, I understand that. No, what I'm referring to is just basic black letter law. Having come, as I did, from the Court of Appeals, I think I would find it very troubling if a year later, while the Court of Appeals is reviewing a matter and trying to decide what happened, then the trial court woke up on a Monday morning and said, I'd like to go back to Smith versus Barney, and I think I can do a better shot at it.
No question. And that is what happened in Raber and what happened in Carlisle.
And here?
No.
No?
No. Raber and Carlisle did not involve plea agreements. Raber specifically involved a sex offender that the state of Ohio was able to put forth evidence to support any sort of sex offender classification as part of his sentence. And so the court just didn't do it, just did not rule in any way on whether or not the defendant was a sex offender. About a year later, exactly what you said happened. Somebody woke up, I think it was the prosecutor, and said, this person is running around out there and he does not have a sex offender classification. And I don't know if people were asking questions. So the court did, post-sentence, pull that case back in before it and had not one but two sex offender hearings.
I understand, and you're trying to invite us down into the void versus voidable, and I'm not going there this morning.
Okay.
I just want you to understand, that's not where I'm going.
Okay.
My question is black letter law.
Does
a common pleas court have the ability to revisit what they did last year?
Yes.
Why?
Because a final judgment may be collaterally attacked, and that comes into play under Rule 32.1, which is what the state used in this case, which is arguable. I would say that because the defendant was acquiescing in the motion to withdraw his plea, he was in essence, it falls under Rule 32.1. However,
counsel, I see from your brief that you argue that the trial court retained jurisdiction. Is that what you're basing your argument on?
Part of it.
In that case, I think your friends on the other side say that there's no mention in the plea agreement as to retaining jurisdiction. So where does that retention of jurisdiction come from?
It comes from the record, and I think it also comes from the plea agreement. The record in this case, at the time of the first sentencing on May 18, 2010, the trial judge said, do you want to enter into this plea, and went through all of the Rule 11 things. The trial judge then said, I am holding in my hand a four-page document, a separate plea agreement that you have signed. Do you acknowledge this? Yes. Did you sign it? Yes. Do you agree to abide by this agreement? And right before the judge said that, he said, are you aware that I am going to proceed to sentence you today? So it was the understanding of the parties that the future performance of the defendant was going to happen after that day in court. In fact, from a practical standpoint, it's in the transcript of the plea, the investigation into the defendant's father, in this case, who was the defendant he was cooperating against, that had just begun. And we can get into the practical reasons why this plea went down the way that it did. But in answer to your questions, this was contemplated by the parties, addressed point by point. And so the court was, yes, in essence, retaining jurisdiction. But that's not really the key that I think promotes the idea of reversing the first district. I think the idea is that finality can be
challenged.
Counsel,
would you speak into the microphone?
Sorry. Finality can be challenged. It can be collaterally attacked. And that is something that the dissent in Gilbert 2 talked about, and the concurring opinion in Gilbert 2 also spoke about. The concurring opinion said that the state is out of luck, unfortunately, because there's nothing in the criminal rules that provide for the withdrawal of a plea post-sentence, exactly what you're talking about. And the answer to that question is that is not true. And I believe
you think 32.1 allows for the withdrawal of the guilty plea or the withdrawal of the plea to correct a manifest injustice. The court after sentence may set aside the judgment of conviction. Is that's what your
what 32.1 turns on is who the asking party is. It's not the language I would submit, and this is briefed in the OPAA amicus brief. I would say that there's a simpler way to do this, and that is to read the concurrence, which says there's nothing in the criminal rules. Then what do? Under criminal rule 57, you jump to the civil rules, and the civil rules is 60B. And 60B allows for a collateral attack on a final judgment when there's been fraud. And really, if there's any other good reason to do it, I believe is the language of the case. It includes relief from final judgment under instances of misrepresentation or misconduct by adverse party, also where it is no longer equitable that the judgment should have prospective application. And then it says any other reason justifying relief from judgment. I would also submit.
So, counsel, you're inviting us now to apply the civil rules to a criminal sentencing.
Absolutely, because this was a plea agreement, which are contracts. They are civil in nature, and plea agreements are subject to contract law standards. And I think that the best place to look for...
Wouldn't a better way to be for the trial court to say you're getting 18 years, but if you violate our contract, I'm giving you more?
You mean give him 18 years and then sentence him?
Sentence him to 18 years with the condition that you can cooperate with the prosecutors, and if you don't, you're getting 29 years.
Well, at what point does that second sentence get imposed?
Well, I would hope it would be imposed rather than you having to come to the Supreme Court of Ohio.
But are you saying that would be, I mean, the purpose of a contract is to ensure future performance. Future performance is what we needed, what the state of Ohio needed in this case. What happened was there was an agreement. As long as everybody did their part, the defendant here seeks to retain the benefit of the bargain and not perform. That does not protect the integrity of the process at all.
Counsel, are there situations where the judge will just refuse to sentence until the determination is made whether the defendant has performed according to the plea agreement?
Yes, certainly.
Would that not have happened in this case?
I'm going to be very practical here. There are reasons why that is not a good idea. This was one of those cases. This was an exceptional case. First of all, the investigation had just begun. You're talking about leaving this case against Kareem Gilbert open in the trial court on one judge's calendar for, in this case, it was almost another year.
He would have been in jail. The time would have been counting against his 18 years, so there's no detriment to the defendant to do this. You don't close the door on a modification of that sentence because of he has not been sentenced. And you're waiting the resolution, and there's justification here for doing that. The judge would not have been subject to criticism for having a criminal case on his docket longer than, you know, the prescribed time. There's always exceptions. So I don't understand why the state took this route.
Because the judge, well, there's a couple of reasons. One is the judge was interested in having that case concluded from his docket. He had no idea how, and they report every month the cases that are on their docket, and that is very important to most judges, I would assume. The second thing is, from a practical standpoint, we have a Hamilton County Justice Center. It is housing these two individuals. this case was already about the murder of a witness. Quite honestly, there were two people dead at this point. We were really trying to keep the mortality rate down. We needed to separate these two individuals from each other.
Well, separate jails, put them in another jail. I mean, there's options here that were not utilized. That's all I'm saying. And now you're coming to us and say, let's make law for the entire state of Ohio that says once a judge sentences a defendant, and then there's this other task that needs to be performed by the defendant, the court retains jurisdiction. Once a person is sentenced and shipped, there is still a retention of jurisdiction. And quite frankly, that is contrary to, I think, every practice that trial court judges have utilized up to this point.
Well, and I would direct this court's attention to the United States versus Santabello, which recognizes that trial courts retain jurisdiction for a post-sentence breach in the interest of protecting a contract and upholding a contract. In Santabello, it was a plea bargain whereby the prosecutor said, I'm not going to recommend anything on sentence. The date of sentence came, a new prosecutor stepped in the room and said, I'd like to see this defendant get a year. The defense protested. The judge said, I'm not going to consider that. I know what the last prosecutor said. The defendant was sentenced to prison time and appealed. The United States Supreme Court came back and said, it is so important that this plea agreement be upheld that even in this case of inadvertence on the part of the prosecutor, we're sending it back. And they sent it back.
Who made the motion to set aside that?
The defendant. Right.
Okay, we have the state, the movement here.
Absolutely, but I think what governs here, it doesn't matter. You have two parties to a contract, and if plea bargains are based in contract law, there is no justification for holding one party to having one party receive the benefit of the bargain and the other party and not performing.
Counsel, how did Gilbert breach the agreement?
Which agreement?
He had a plea agreement to testify truthfully against his father, right, in a separate case. How did he breach that?
Oh, I thought you said how did he reach that. How did he breach it? He came back and he had given about a 50-page in transcript terms, statement of how his father in his presence had killed the witness. When he came back and was brought back to testify, he said that my father was with me and we were elsewhere. It was basically an alibi.
But didn't you have his prior recorded testimony under oath?
Yes. They had a tape statement. I don't think it was a deposition.
With counsel, I'm looking at Judge Fisher's concurrence, and I'm not understanding this. Regrettably, Kareem Gilbert may escape conviction because he was sentenced before he fulfilled a material obligation on his plea agreement. What does that mean?
I believe he is trying to say there's nothing in the criminal rules. For example, there's nothing that Rule 32.1 should not apply to the state being allowed to move to withdraw a plea. That's what I'm guessing he means there, and that there's no statutory provision that would allow the state to move exactly as.
Escape his conviction. The lead opinion sends it back for the imposition of his original sentence, doesn't it?
It does. Did that say murder conviction, Your Honor? Because it was originally
escape conviction.
That was a manslaughter conviction.
Right,
originally.
Right. He originally pled to manslaughter and then came back and was sentenced to the murder.
So he's not going to be walking around Cincinnati, right?
Yes, that is correct, Judge.
Regardless of the outcome here.
Regardless.
Counsel, I know we're out of time, but I do have one question because I'm going to ask if you're opposing. You will agree jurisdiction for a common pleas court comes from either the Constitution or a statute, correct? It's the only way they have jurisdiction, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you are hanging your hat on this case on Rule 32.1?
No, not necessarily.
How does the court have jurisdiction then? The short answer. Where does their jurisdiction?
Waiver. The short answer is waiver.
Waiver by whom?
Waiver by the defendant.
Waiver. Okay.
Am I out of? Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Karen.
Mr. Clark.
And the answer was waiver, and I'm scratching my head. Why would he do that?
May it please the court, with all due respect, there was no waiver. Going to, I think, Justice O'Connor's initial question to Ms. Maykole, before you get to the issue of waiver, you have to first determine the trial court had the jurisdiction to even entertain the state's motion to vacate the plea.
Right.
This court, in the last 3 years, in Carlisle, Raber, and again in Miller, has said the trial court lacks authority to revisit or reconsider its own valid final judgment. There's no dispute that this judgment was final under Rule 32 when it was filed with the clerk. There's no dispute that it is valid. There's no clerical error, and it's not void.
What's the meaning of the language in the plea agreement that says if it's determined by the prosecutor's office that the defendant fails to cooperate, refuses to testify, testifies falsely, gives false misleading information, compromises his values as a witness, et cetera, then the office may reinstate the original charge against the defendant as well as any additional charges. They'll be returned to their respective positions prior to execution of the agreement, with the expressed exception that the proffer statement of the defendant is admissible. Additionally, the defendant waives any argument of double jeopardy, speedy trial. What does that mean?
That means that after the trial court accepts this plea, that is provided with this plea agreement, but before sentencing, if Mr. Gilbert
that does, doesn't say before sentencing, does it?
I realize it doesn't say before sentencing, but you have to interpret the agreement in the context of what the established law is. The prosecutor makes the point that there's some implied retention of jurisdiction between the parties that says the trial court retains jurisdiction to modify this plea post-sentencing.
Well, wasn't there an agreement on your client's part to testify truthfully?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Was there an agreement on your client's part to testify truthfully?
That is a condition of the agreement, correct.
Did he do that?
To my knowledge, the allegation is no.
Why would that not be a fraud committed on the court?
I think before you get to the issue of fraud, you have to take two steps back. One is he gave a 50-page proffer that may or may not have been truthful. So whether his testimony at trial was truthful is only been able to be determined by the prosecutor in comparison to what his previous statements were. He was also obligated to give that proffer. But before you consider the question of the fraud or the content of this plea agreement, you have to first accept or get past that the trial court had no jurisdiction after his judgment entry was recorded on May 24th of 2010.
Well, it says here that the state would enter into an agreed prison sentence of 18 years with the defendant.
And that's exactly what they did. They entered into an agreed sentence, but it doesn't say when that sentence would be imposed. And as this court has pointed out, and I think Bobby Bethel, which was the last time I appeared before the court when I represented Mr. Bethel, is a textbook example of how this prosecutor's office should have handled this plea.
Why would the defendant have waived double jeopardy then?
Because at the time...
You agree he can waive double jeopardy.
Because you can make a knowing voluntary waiver of any constitutional right, I agree. Because at the time the plea is accepted, if he violates the terms of the plea prior to his conviction becoming final, that waiver makes sense. But I don't think you can even get to the terms of the plea agreement unless you first determine that the trial court had jurisdiction somehow to consider the motion to set aside.
And you reject the analysis that the breach of the plea agreement should be conducted under Civil Rule 60 as a vacation.
Absolutely.
To which your client agreed.
Absolutely. Because the trial court didn't have jurisdiction to ask him to agree.
And your client voluntarily pled to a subsequent murder conviction.
If you
and agreed to that.
If you look at the procedural posture, it was that or go to trial, but the trial court had no jurisdiction to even accept a plea from him. They had no jurisdiction to set aside the plea. They had no jurisdiction to vacate its order from May 24th of 2010.
So your analysis is that we can't look at the civil rules in order to set aside a plea agreement?
I think there's a constitutional reason for that also. So the, short answer to your question is yes, that's my position, but there's a constitutional reason also. Civil rules don't have any implication in terms of double jeopardy. A defendant has an expectation of finality once his sentence has been properly filed, as we have here in Rule 32, and even then considering the expiration of an appeal period by either side. He has an expectation of that sentence being final when there's no void issues in it.
And has no obligation to comply with the terms of the plea agreement that he negotiated.
Literally, under the facts we have here, you're right. Because once that judgment entry is put on...
Oh, I'm not saying that's right. I'm asking you if it's right.
I think that's exactly what happened here. Once the trial court put the sentencing entry on May 24, 2010, it lost jurisdiction. I don't think Kareem Gilbert knew and understood that, clearly not, but I think that's the practical result of what happened. Justice O'Connor, in a recent argument that I watched, said that agreement of the parties, or in that case, the defendant's school schedule, doesn't trump the law. There's nothing in here that allows the trial court to retain jurisdiction once the judgment is final. And the bottom line is, once that entry was put on May 24th, as Justice O'Neill's pointed out, it's kind of black letter. This court has for 100 years said the reason for finality is just that, expectation of things being final.
So anytime there is a plea agreement or there's a plea bargain that is going to require the defendant to perform something in the future, the trial court should not sentence until that has been completed. Is that the position you wish the court to take?
I think the trial court should not sentence if it wants to retain jurisdiction and have any kind of ability to, I'll say, interpret or rule on the plea agreement, absolutely. In federal court, that happens every day. In Bobby Bethel, that's what happened. The issue in Bethel was not the court's jurisdiction. The issue was an interpretation of some conflicting provisions in the plea document itself.
But when you have the requirement for the defendant to perform something, in lieu of a better deal, let's say, the court shouldn't sentence until there's an actual performance. Is that the position you're taking?
It absolutely. Okay. Now, my preference as a criminal defense attorney, they can be sentenced probably sooner the better. But once they are sentenced, they lose the jurisdiction to enforce the plea. All this court's case law is basically black letter on that issue.
Counsel, did the state have other options once he had failed to cooperate in the testimony against his father? Could they have charged him with anything out of the original course of conduct? Could they have additional charges against him? Part of that plea agreement that...
The short answer would be yes.
They were dismissing charges, but in essence, without prejudice?
I don't know that you could say they're without prejudice, because I think it was part of the negotiated plea. Some were reduced from murder to manslaughter, and I'm not sure what was dismissed, but there was a weapons under and something else. But I think, at a minimum, there were other charges. They had a proffer that clearly told a story of A, B, and C. When he was brought back to testify, his testimony clearly contradicted that. So possibly either perjury, obstructing justice, obstructing official business. I think out of that conduct in and of itself, they absolutely had other options. And I don't think there would have been an issue at all in terms of this plea, because those are separate offenses, so to speak. They're not even contemplated by this. The short is, the problem that this case presents for the state is a mishandling of the case by the prosecutor's office. If they wanted to have the ability to enforce the plea agreement against Kareem Gilbert, they should not have allowed him to have been sentenced. I don't know, in my almost 25 years of criminal defense work, I can't imagine a trial judge going, I have to sentence him, I have to get him off my docket, knowing that the plea agreement was in place and the obligations of Kareem Gilbert.
What happened to the father's case?
It's my understanding that Kareem testified at his father's case. The father was convicted anyhow, and I think is doing life plus whatever underlying charges there might be with that. I think one of the other things that the state does forget, and I don't know that it's really an issue, but I guess maybe as a collateral thought, the state did get the benefit of its bargain. because part of the bargain was that Kareem had to give a proffer, and that's, I think, what Justice O'Donnell mentioned. He gave that proffer, and as pointed out in the state's argument, that was then used against him when his testimony changed at trial. The other aspect is, and this is why you shouldn't make a rule that lets you undermine and get into plea agreements, a lot of plea agreements are conditioned on the premise of you will testify in the future against a certain defendant. Once that defendant finds out there are people willing to testify against him, that defendant then pleas. Testimony is not necessary. So if he had not been called to testify, the same behavior would have been in place, admittedly, but the state wouldn't be in a position to claim a breach because they did get some benefit out of it. So when you talk about plea agreements and that the First District's decision will undermine the ability for plea agreements to be entered into and to be effective, that really is not, it's kind of a red herring. I don't think it's true. We all know 90%+ of criminal cases are resolved with plea agreements. But I think it's the attorneys involved in the actual negotiation, the handling of it, and communicating with the court in terms of, Judge, we should or should not proceed with sentencing and so on, that really determine the effectiveness of it. And this court very simply should affirm the First District's decision for two reasons. Its long history of holding that a trial court does not have jurisdiction to revisit its valid final judgment, and to do otherwise, and this is why the civil rules should not be applied, is a violation of double jeopardy under both the Ohio and United States Constitution.
But we permit collateral attacks on judgments for purposes of fraud, and you said your client committed a fraud against the court. I think Judge Dinkelacker referenced that analysis in his dissent.
Well, Judge Dinkelacker referenced that, but he made no reference or no acknowledgement of the case law that is very well established. Judge Dinkelacker also in his dissent, and I highlighted this, said that Gilbert did not seek justice, he thwarted it. Well, it's not the defendant looking at a murder charge. It's not his obligation to seek justice. To seek justice is the job that we give prosecutors. That's their assigned task. I think it's United States versus Berger. Prosecutors aren't to get convictions at any rate. They're there to do justice.
Well, your client agreed in writing that he would testify truthfully, and he absolutely, he told us he breached that.
He did. And had the prosecutor's office wanted to hold him to that and have some way to enforce that promise in writing that he made, it's very simple. Don't have him sentenced. Because the parties can't agree to change the law in this case.
All right. I understand what
Thank
your
you.
Position
Thank
is.
You. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds. Counsel, if we don't agree with you, is there any reason for us to even write on this case?
Yes, I believe United States v. Ricketts speaks to, one, the fact that a defendant can be brought back after a breach after he has been sentenced, and two, there is language in the Ricketts dissent that speaks exactly to your questions about finality, and even the dissent in that case acknowledged that the defendant's interest in protecting the final judgment as to his guilt was substantial. I'm reading from the defendant and Ricketts did not consciously take any action that would undermine the integrity of that judgment. He did not deliberately choose to breach his plea agreement. That is the law that governs in this case, because that is exactly what happened in this, with the defendant reneging on a plea agreement. And I would also point, which I did in my brief, to the court's language in Bethel, where this court declined to create a right for a defendant to renege on a plea agreement.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you please call a recess?